From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on This Day in Maine, Wednesday, July 31st, 2019. Democratic Governor Janet Mills says Maine is ready to take advantage of a Trump administration proposal that would allow Americans to legally and safely import lower-cost prescription drugs from Canada. The administration announced the plan today. It reverses years of opposition from federal health authorities. We'll have more on that story in a moment. The Navy's applying for a permit to dredge some of the Kennebec River to allow the passage of destroyers built at Bath Iron Works. The Times Record reports the permit would allow deepening the river from Bath to Phippsburg. Federal regulators are scheduling a series of public hearings on proposed new fishing gear rules that aim to protect the endangered North Atlantic right whale from potentially deadly entanglements. Fred Bever has more.
The controversial rules could force Maine lobstermen to remove from the water half the rope they use to haul their traps and to use rope that would break more easily. Conservationists say the rules are needed to avert the whale's potential extinction. Colin Coogan coordinates whale protection efforts at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's North Atlantic Fisheries Bureau. Coogan says NOAA wants to know how the new rules would affect marine ecosystems and animals, including whales. But she says officials are also looking for fishermen's views on how their operations and businesses might be affected by specific gear changes.
So, for instance, if we're asking them to increase their gear marking, maybe putting a large 3-foot-long mark in the top 2 fathoms of their buoy line. Would that be something they do at the dock and bring out with them? Is that something they would do while at sea? How hard would that be to do? How much time would it take? What do they think the cost to them would be?
The first scoping meeting in Maine is scheduled for the evening of Monday, August 12th, at the University of Maine at Machias, with subsequent meetings that week in Ellsworth, Waldoboro, and Portland. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And you can find the complete notice of the meetings and their purpose at our website, mainepublic.org. And a Victorian-era train depot that later housed a macrame bead shop, a bike business, and the headquarters of Toms of Maine is up for sale in Kennebunk. The Boston Globe reports the 4,125-square-foot wood-frame building's listed at $939,000 and is currently the home of Dietz Associates, Inc., a creative design and marketing firm. In weather tonight, thunder ending with some clearing, but showers and fog down east. Lows overnight in the mid-50s to mid-60s. Maine Democrats and health advocates are praising an announcement today from the Trump administration that it will explore ways to import cheaper prescription drugs from Canada. The announcement bolsters a new state law signed by Governor Janet Mills to develop a wholesale drug importation program from our neighbors to the north. But as Patty White reports, some health policy experts are skeptical that such a plan is viable.
Democratic Senate President Troy Jackson was the sponsor of Maine's bill to establish a drug importation program with Canada, and he says it's about time that the federal government took action to lower drug prices.
You know, we put a lot of effort in this session, and it always was to push the federal government, you know, to do what was right, and it seems like that's finally coming to fruition, and so I feel a real sense of hope in that regard.
His bill was signed into law by Governor Mills, but it ultimately requires federal approval. The Trump administration's announcement signals that's more likely. And Ann Woolison of Consumers for Affordable Healthcare says it could happen relatively quickly.
The hope would be that Maine would be able to do something sooner than later, perhaps in the next year, year and a half.
But others are less confident that any plans to import drugs from Canada are viable. Maine-based independent health policy consultant Mitchell Stein says one reason is that the U.S. market for prescription drugs is exponentially larger than Canada's.
We've seen busloads of people going into Canada and going to a drugstore, and that can work, but it just can't scale. There currently isn't the supply in Canada.
And Stein is doubtful that Canada would be able to increase its supply.
There's no reason to think that manufacturers would be willing to increase the lower cost supply when they're currently getting more money here in the U.S.
Stein also points to a recent report in Reuters. The news outlet obtained documents that revealed Canadian officials are opposed to U.S. plans that threaten the supply and cost of prescription drugs for its own citizens. Senator Jackson, however, says that's not the message he's getting in his discussions with officials in New Brunswick and Quebec.
I mean, I think we could do that tomorrow if you know, we had a plan that was approved by the federal government. I mean, they're waiting, you know, ready and willing.
Ann Woolison from Consumers for Affordable Healthcare also thinks Canadian suppliers would be motivated to export more drugs because of the financial benefits.
I hear the skepticism, but I don't honestly believe that it's going to be a problem. And we can't not attempt to do this, especially if the end effect means that mean people will ultimately end up paying less for the drugs that they need.
Governor Janet Mills is ready to press forward with Maine's program. In a media release, she says she spoke to U.S. Health Secretary Alex Azar Wednesday to let him know that Maine is ready to review, shape, and take advantage of the new rule. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
For many, the Great American Road Trip wouldn't be complete without some camping and hiking in some of the most beautiful spots on Earth. According to the Department of the Interior, more than 330 million people will visit a national park this year, and a lot of them will be driving. But as visitors rush to get away from it all, they are bringing with them some problems from the big city. Jennifer Mitchell has more.
Terrible traffic is probably the last thing you expect to encounter up a mountain in one of the most rural states in the nation. But at Acadia National Park, it's becoming a regular problem.
You definitely want to get early, you know, get up early and, you know, get parked.
Here, there's nobody here. There's like five cars. Yeah.
But if you get here like now, there's cars
now,
parked down the street. Yeah,
like when we did 2 days ago, we got here at what, 11, 12? You're lying down the road.
That's Nate Bossy and Ray Penn visiting from Connecticut for the first time. They say the trip was totally worth it for the biking and hiking trails, the mountains and the wilderness once they were safely parked. Located within a day's drive from the most densely populated part of the country, Acadia receives 3.5 million visits each year. And sometimes there just isn't room for everyone on a given day.
Well, for example, at Cadillac Mountain, which is one of the key destinations here in Acadia, we have 155 parking spaces at the top of the mountain. And on a busy day, we can have as many as 400, 500, even 600 cars vying for one of those parking spaces.
And as vehicles wait for spots to open up, Acadia Superintendent Kevin Schneider says the area can become choked with cars so that no one is able to get through, including emergency responders. It was an especially challenging problem on July 5th this summer. That was the park's busiest day ever, with more than 750 calls for assistance and at least 20 emergencies. Dangerous congestion last summer also led park officials to close the road more than 50 times, which meant visitors were denied one of the park's most iconic views.
And so, you know, that's not the kind of experience we want to be able to provide our visitors.
Acadia has seen a 59% increase in visits over the last 10 years, says Schneider, and a lot of those people are driving into the park. To try to reduce the traffic, Acadia adopted a new transportation plan, which has yet to be implemented. It includes a reservations-only parking system for some of Acadia's busiest spots during the summer months. That's drawn some fire from local residents who fear that they won't get a chance to visit some of their favorite places in their own backyard, such as Cadillac, Sand Beach, or Jordan Pond. Another part of the plan includes more public transportation options. But for that to be successful, park supporters say a cultural shift in attitude may be necessary.
My generation definitely has a love affair with the car, right? And its national parks. Those two things are very much tied up with what it means to be a baby boomer.
David McDonald grew up locally and has been coming to the park since he was a young child. Now he's president of the nonprofit Friends of Acadia, which works to raise funds to support the park. It took a shift in thinking, but McDonald says he started to ride the free Island Explorer bus, and others may also be willing to do the same.
Kids who are in their teens and 20s, they don't have that same attachment to owning their own private vehicle. International visitors do not have that. So I suspect that as visitation grows, if it grows, it's going to be more of those younger folks, international visitors. And those of us who are more old school, traditional, yes, we have to adjust our ways.
Take a right and go about 100 yards.
After driving around the park, visitors often head to Bar Harbor for meals and shopping, creating congestion there as well, but supporting hundreds of businesses in the process. This summer, there's a new paid parking system in town. Cones, ropes, and signs threatening to tow vehicles have also sprung up. And there are now security personnel checking cars at the local supermarket lot.
This way, hon.
Thank you. So sorry.
Thanks a lot.
No problem. Enjoy your stay.
From a business perspective, is it possible to, you know, have too many tourists in one place at one time?
I think it's possible to diminish the experience.
Originally from South Carolina, Glenn Tucker was drawn to the area by its natural beauty. He runs Acadia Bike and Coastal Kayak downtown, where he rents gear to visitors. He acknowledges that congestion is a problem inside and outside the park, but he says it's essential that the area remain open and welcoming by offering other ways to see the park, arriving by cruise ship, for example, booking small personalized tours, biking, or taking the Island Explorer bus. And he says it's not just a Maine thing. Other parks and park towns are also facing the same challenges.
This is a typical gateway town. In fact, I was in Jackson, Wyoming a couple of years ago, and I looked around and I said, this is Bar Harbor. It's just antlers and cowboys rather than lobsters. So there are attractions here, and it's a small area. And I don't know what the tipping point is. And I'm not sure that the Park Service knows what the tipping point is.
But when you do take that great American road trip, they're really hoping it's the sea, the mountains, and the moose you remember, not the parking lot. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
The state of Maine this week began celebrating its bicentennial, but historian and former lawmaker Herb Adams says the road to statehood was not simple.
It took 35 years. It took 7 state conventions. It took 6 statewide votes. It took a complete turnover of the cast of characters, and it came out different than it went in.
Adams sat down with Erwin Gratz at the Maine Historical Society to talk about how the process of separating itself from Massachusetts helped shape the nation. Adams first walks us through the pivotal year between Mainers' vote for independence and achieving statehood.
In July 1819, Mainers finally voted decisively to separate permanently from Massachusetts, and did so in a public referendum. And that is what we're taking notice of now.
What were the for and against arguments regarding separation from Massachusetts?
Well, we were the very much northern sort of second cousin, 12 times removed, a place where they could sell the lands of Maine to pay the debts of Boston, but in no other respect really take much care of us. However, there was a federal law, and that was called the Coasting Law, passed by the early Congresses so that if you were exporting goods by sea, you were not taxed for import duties any state that bordered yours. Well, that was very advantageous for Mainers. All of that meant that you could get more than halfway down the eastern seaboard of the United States and not pay a penny in import tax.
So what finally impelled the state's voters to make that break?
Finally, one of the things done was the repeal of the Coasting Act. So now it's down to brass tacks. What's Massachusetts offered us? The state is flooded with Revolutionary War veterans, young people looking to make a new start. We're moving just beyond just the coastal communities and the river towns. Now people are going far up into the interior. The state's population has changed completely, and those are the people who have a lot to gain by independence.
So the state votes to separate. What happens between then and March 15, 1820, when the state of Maine officially comes into being?
The process next required that a state constitution be written. That constitution then has to go to the Congress of the United States, and statehood ratified. Maine's card being played on the table meant for the first time that the union of states would be unbalanced. To put Maine into the mix would mean that all of a sudden, instead of being 22 pro-slavery senators and 22 anti, you'd have 2 more free state senators. And so we had to achieve statehood by a vote of the Congress, or else we fell back into the legal possession of Massachusetts. So we're racing a clock, and we're racing uphill against political prejudice that has frozen the United States in this position for the generations since the Revolution. What happens in the House of Representatives is known as the infamous Missouri Compromise. the Speaker of the United States House, a slave owner, manages to engineer a compromise that lets Maine and Missouri Territory into the Union at the same moment. And we accepted, with huge reservations, the deal.
It actually almost derailed Maine's statehood attempt from the standpoint of Mainers who didn't want to be involved in perpetuating slavery.
Absolutely. It's a terrible cradle to be born in. As it was of Maine's 7 United States congressmen at the time, 5 vote against the Missouri Compromise, vote against statehood for their own state.
Does any of this history resonate with modern day Maine?
I think it's wise for us to look back at it. Because in general, you'll find, if it's mentioned at all in the United States history books, the Missouri Compromise is a single sentence. You know, Missouri, slave state, Maine, free state. But of course, it was typical of the huge argument in the country about what kind of a people were we? What kind of a country would we be facing our original sin, which is slavery? We're still in the middle of that, really. We haven't answered it all. I think our remembrance of our origins on our bicentennial in 200 years is part, I think, of our self-study that should go on.
And that's Erwin Gratz speaking with historian Herb Adams. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org and join us tomorrow on Maine Calling at 1 o'clock, where analyst Aaron David Miller discusses national and international news. I'm Nora Flaherty.